For decades, computing just kind of operated under this ironclad expectation of strict, unyielding logic.
Right, totally deterministic.
Exactly. You give the machine a command and it just executes it. I mean, it's basically like handing a chef this highly detailed step-by-step recipe.
Yeah, crack two eggs, add a cup of flour.
Right. Bake at 350 for 20 minutes and boom, out comes the cake.
It's purely rule based. The machine is just compiling and following those rigidly defined instructions to the letter.
But the thing is, the moment we step into artificial intelligence, and specifically the machine learning algorithms we're going over in today's deep dive into AI MLOPS Masters framework from late 2025, that recipe book is just completely thrown out the window.
Oh, totally. It's a completely different paradigm.
Yeah. And our mission here today is to unpack the actual mechanics of these algorithms for you.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they aren't magic, right? They're just these unseen statistical engines that are kind of powering our entire modern world.
Exactly. And to use your baking analogy, if traditional programming is giving a computer a recipe, machine learning is, well, it's like giving a computer a fully stocked kitchen, a huge pile of raw ingredients, and just a picture of a cake.
And just forcing it to figure out the baking process completely on its own.
Right. And to pull off that kind of computational leap, we really have to look at the learning paradigms the machine uses to navigate that kitchen.
But I guess before we even touch the actual algorithms, we have to talk about the ingredients themselves, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, if you just dump raw, unorganized data into an algorithm, it's a guaranteed way to just completely break it.
Right, which brings us to feature selection and feature engineering. I mean, if you're familiar with data science, you know we aren't just tossing entire databases into a blender.
Definitely not.
Feature selection is all about isolating the variables that actually carry a signal. I actually look at it a lot like an audio engineer mixing a track.
Oh, that's a really good way to think about it.
Yeah, you have to strip out the background hiss, the ambient noise, you know, all those redundant frequencies, just so the vocal track, which is the actual signal, can be processed clearly by the equalizer.
And the computational reality of that audio engineer analogy is just crucial. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't strip out the noise, you run headfirst into what we call overfitting.
Right, overfitting, which is basically a nightmare.
Yeah, it really is. Overfitting is when a model essentially just memorizes the noise in your training data rather than actually learning the underlying mathematical patterns.
So it looks smart in practice, but it's actually just regurgitating stuff.
Exactly. So by using techniques like correlation analysis or mutual information to rank and select features, we actively constrain the model's focus.
Making it focus on what actually matters.
Right. We force it to build a generalized mathematical representation of the data, and that dramatically accelerates training time and, more importantly, ensures the model actually works when it encounters new unseen data out in the real world.
Okay, so once we've selected those crucial features, packed our bags with only what we need, basically we move to feature engineering. And this is where we're physically altering the data to be like mathematically palatable for the algorithm.
Because algorithms are ultimately just matrix multiplication engines. I mean, they only speak numbers.
Right. So if we have categorical data, like a column in a spreadsheet that just says city or color, we have to encode that into numeric vectors. But it goes way beyond just encoding, doesn't it? We also have to scale and normalize the data.
Yeah, and scaling is non-negotiable for most of these algorithms. Imagine you have a data set where one feature is, say, a house price in the millions of dollars.
Okay.
And another feature right next to it is the local interest rate, which is a tiny decimal, like 0.05.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. If we don't scale these down to a standardized range, say, between 0 and 1, the algorithm's gradient descent is going to just mathematically hyperfixate on the larger numbers.
Because it just assumes the millions are inherently way more important than the tiny fractions.
Exactly. It completely skews the model's weights.
Wow. Okay. So our data is encoded, it's scaled, it's stripped of all that noise. The fuel is officially ready. So let's get into how the machine actually processes it. The most foundational paradigm in the text is supervised learning, right?
Yes, supervised learning. This is what we call the guided path.
Right, where we're mapping input features to known target outputs using labeled data. So the machine actually has an answer key.
Precisely. The algorithm makes a prediction, compares it against that ground truth label, calculates its error, and then updates its internal weights so it can minimize that error the next time around.
And the framework splits this into two main operational domains, right? Regression and classification. Let's start with regression.
Sure. So regression is for predicting continuous numerical outputs. So things like forecasting next quarter's revenue or predicting a temperature.
And linear regression is kind of the baseline there, right?
Yeah.
Like literally fitting a line of best fit right through a scatter plot of data points.
Yeah, it's the classic approach. But, you know, linear models really start to fail when the data gets complex and messy.
Which real world data almost always is.
Exactly. Which is why we have to bring in things like ridge regression or support vector regression. Ridge regression is actually particularly elegant.
Oh, why is that?
Well, it introduces something called L2 regularization. Basically, it adds a penalty term to the algorithm's loss function that's based on the size of the model's coefficients.
Wait, so it actively penalizes the model if it gets too complicated?
Yes. It mathematically shrinks the impact of the less important features. So it acts as a built-in safeguard against that overfitting problem we just talked about.
That's super clever. Okay, so on the flip side of regression, we have classification. And here, we aren't predicting like a sliding scale of numbers anymore. We are drawing distinct boundaries to categorize discrete classes.
Right, like spam or not spam, benign or malignant.
Right, and we use tools like logistic regression if we want probabilities. But the real heavyweight in this space, at least historically, has been the support vector machine, the SVM.
Oh, SVMs are fascinating. Their entire goal is to find the optimal hyperplane to separate classes in a high-dimensional space.
Right, and the support vectors are just the data points that lie closest to that decision boundary, right?
Exactly. The algorithm just maximizes the margin, basically the empty space between those closest points and the boundary line.
But the thing is, data in the wild is rarely just linearly separable. Like, you can't always just draw a nice, clean, straight line between class A and class B.
No, almost never. And this is where SVMs use what's called the kernel trick.
The kernel trick. I love that name.
It's great, right? Instead of struggling to draw this incredibly complex, squiggly boundary in two dimensions, the kernel function mathematically projects the data into three, four, or even higher dimensions.
Oh, wow. So it literally elevates the data points into a 3D space.
Exactly. Yeah. It elevates them until you can just slice a perfectly flat, rigid plane right between the two classes. It's just this brilliant piece of geometric trickery.
That really is phenomenal geometry. But the source text mentions that SVMs are computationally super heavy, right? So sometimes you need a tree-based approach. Which brings us to decision trees.
Yes, decision trees.
And I have to admit, reading through the framework, decision trees always struck me as a little bit, I don't know, rudimentary. Like, it's essentially just a massive algorithmic flowchart.
Well, yeah, essentially.
Like, if value X is greater than 10, go left. If less, go right. I mean, sure, it's highly interpretable. You could easily read it. But it feels really fragile. And honestly, it raises a big question for me. Why do we need the whole evolution of the random forest if we already have the decision tree?
You actually just hit on the exact vulnerability of a single decision tree right there. Fragility.
Really? How so?
Well, a single tree is what we call a greedy algorithm. It will just keep splitting and growing deeper and deeper until it has perfectly classified every single solitary point in the training data.
Oh, so it's going to capture all the noise.
Every single outlier, every anomaly, it leads to massive overfitting. It completely memorizes the training set, but then totally collapses in the real world when it sees new data.
Ah, okay. And so the random forest introduces, like, the wisdom of the crowd.
Exactly. Through mechanisms called bootstrapping and feature randomness, a random forest doesn't just build one tree, it generates an ensemble of hundreds of shallower trees.
Okay, hundreds of them.
But the crucial part is that each tree is trained on a totally random subset of the data. And at each split, it's only allowed to look at a random subset of the features.
So you are mathematically forcing the trees to be diverse.
Yes.
Like, no single tree can dominate the decision making because they are all looking at slightly different fragments of the overall picture. And then, when it's time to predict, they all just cast a vote.
Exactly. And averaging out those votes drastically reduces the variance in the error.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's kind of a glaring limitation to everything we've discussed so far.
Which is the labels.
Right. Oh, supervised learning, whether we're talking about an elegant SVM or a massive random forest, it totally demands labeled data. And in the wild, data is just messy and overwhelmingly unlabeled.
We generate petabytes of it. Server logs, user clicks, transaction histories, just every single day.
Yeah, and nobody is sitting in a cubicle manually attaching ground truth labels to all of that. So when we don't have the answer key, we have to shift paradigms again, We have to move to unsupervised learning.
Right, which completely flips the script. Unsupervised learning requires the algorithm to just discover the intrinsic structure of the data completely on its own.
With no guide.
No guide at all. And it does this primarily through clustering and dimensionality reduction.
Okay, let's talk about clustering. The text highlights k-means as the real workhorse here, right?
Yeah, k-means is everywhere.
And the way I understand it, you basically tell the algorithm how many clusters you want. That's the k part. And then the algorithm just drops k random centroids or center points into the data space.
Right. It just drops them in randomly at first.
Then it measures the geometric distance from every single data point to those random centroids, assigns the points to the nearest one, and then it recalculates the actual physical center of those new groups.
Exactly. It shifts the centroid to that new center and then just repeats that loop over and over until the clusters stop moving.
Which sounds super efficient. But k-means kind of assumes your clusters are nice, neat spheres, right?
Yeah.
And roughly the same size.
Yeah, and real data is rarely that polite. That's why the MLOPS framework really highlights DBSCAN.
DBSCAN, right. How is that different?
Well, DBSCAN takes a density-based approach. It doesn't actually care about the distance to this arbitrary center point. Instead, it looks for continuous, densely packed regions of data.
So it's just looking for crowds.
Basically, yeah. If it finds a tight cluster of points, it groups them together, which means it can find clusters of literally any bizarre, irregular shape.
And more importantly, at least from a business perspective, DBSCAN is fantastic for anomaly detection.
Oh, absolutely.
Because anything that falls outside of those dense, crowded regions is simply left unclustered. It just gets flagged as noise.
Right. And if you are, say, monitoring live bank transactions, those isolated noise points, those are your potential fraud cases.
Wow. Okay. So beyond clustering, unsupervised learning also tackles dimensionality reduction. Because when you are dealing with data sets that have thousands and thousands of features, the computational cost just skyrockets.
We call that the curse of dimensionality.
The curse of dimensionality sounds ominous. And this is where PCA comes in, right? Principal component analysis.
Yes. PCA is vital.
I always visualize PCA like you're casting a shadow of a 3D object onto a flat 2D wall. You want to rotate the object around until the shadow captures the most distinct, recognizable silhouette of the object.
That is a brilliant visualization. Mathematically, what PCA is doing is transforming the original features into new uncorrelated variables, which we call principal components.
Okay, principal components.
Right. It projects the data onto the axes that maximize the variance. So it allows us to squash thousands of dimensions down to maybe just 10 or 20, while still retaining like 95% of the critical information.
It's an incredible compression technique.
It really is. The linear projection of PCA is incredibly powerful. But if you want to actually visualize this stuff, the framework points us to TSNE.
Right. TSNE.
Yeah. TSNE is a nonlinear technique. It's specifically designed to preserve local neighborhoods of data. It takes highly complex multidimensional relationships like word embeddings and natural language processing and maps them down into a 2D or 3D space.
So human engineers can actually pull up a graph and visibly comprehend how the algorithm is grouping similar concepts together.
Exactly. It makes the incomprehensible actually visible.
Amazing. So, okay, we have supervised learning for our static labeled data sets and unsupervised learning for our raw, unorganized data. But what happens when the environment itself is dynamic?
Like constantly changing?
Yeah, like think about an autonomous drone navigating through a dense forest or, you know, an algorithmic trading bot operating in a livestock market. The data isn't just sitting neatly in a spreadsheet. It's streaming in as a continuous sequence of states.
Right, and that requires an entirely different approach. Reinforcement learning, or RL.
RL, right.
In RL, we deploy what we call an agent into an environment. The agent observes its current state, it takes an action, and then the environment returns a new state along with a reward or a penalty.
And the agent's sole ruthless objective is to just maximize its cumulative future reward.
Exactly. It's essentially trial and error codified into pure math. We use algorithms like Q learning, where the Q basically stands for the quality of a given action.
And how does that work in practice?
Well, the algorithm builds this massive matrix, a Q table, that maps every single possible state to every possible action. Every time the agent does something, it updates the Q value based on the reward it gets, slowly learning a policy that dictates the optimal move for literally any situation.
But wait, in complex environments like playing a high-resolution video game or running a robotic arm, there have to be millions, if not billions, of possible states. A traditional Q table would require like an impossible amount of computer memory, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would be computationally impossible. That's exactly why we use deep Q networks or DQNs.
Ah, bringing deep learning into it.
Right. DQNs replace that giant lookup table with a neural network that just approximates the optimal action instead.
Got it. Now, reading the text, it seems the biggest bottleneck in reinforcement learning is this exploration versus exploitation dilemma.
Oh, that is the classic RL problem.
It really feels like an algorithm's version of a very human struggle.
Mm.
Like, imagine you are hungry on a Friday night, right?
Mm.
Do you go to your absolute favorite restaurant? That's exploitation, because you know for a fact the reward is high.
Right. You know it's going to be good.
Exactly.
Mm.
Or do you try the sketchy new food truck that just opened down the street?
Yeah.
That's exploration. It might be terrible and give you food poisoning,
mm-hmm.
but it might also yield an even higher reward than your usual spot.
Yeah, that's the exact dynamic. And the mathematical risk for the algorithm is that if an agent only exploits its current knowledge, it gets trapped in what we call a local optimum.
Meaning it settles.
Yeah, it finds a mediocre strategy that kind of works, and it never discovers the truly optimal strategy. But on the flip side, if it only explores, it just acts randomly forever and never actually maximizes its reward.
So how do we balance that computationally? The text mentions epsilon greedy strategies.
Yes, epsilon greedy. We set epsilon as a decay parameter.
A decay parameter. Okay, meaning what?
Meaning early in training, epsilon is very high. So the agent mathematically forces itself to take completely random exploratory actions, say 90% of the time. But as it learns, that epsilon value decays.
So by the end of training, the agent is exploiting its refined knowledge like 99% of the time and only occasionally trying something new.
Exactly. Alternatively, you can use UCB upper confidence bound.
Right, UCB.
UCB applies a mathematical bonus to actions that haven't been tried in a long time. It actually calculates the uncertainty of an action, forcing the agent to explore the unknown, not just through pure randomness, but through this sort of calculated curiosity.
It's so fascinating how we can algorithmically simulate curiosity.
It really is.
And yeah, but before we leave this sort of middle ground of learning, we should probably touch on semi-supervised learning.
Oh, definitely. It's incredibly useful.
Because it acts as a bridge, right? Utilizing just a tiny fraction of really expensive labeled data alongside a massive ocean of cheap unlabeled data.
The mechanism is really elegant. You train a basic model on your small labeled data set first. And then you use that model to generate what we call pseudo-labels for the massive unlabeled data set.
Oh, so it labels the rest of the data itself.
Exactly. And then you retrain a brand new model on this newly combined pool. In fields like medical imaging, where, you know, expert radiologists are way too expensive to sit there and label a million scans, this drastically reduces costs while still maintaining high performance.
That is incredibly practical.
Okay.
So let's move to the heavyweight division. When we talk about processing live video feeds, parsing complex audio, or, you know, generating human-like text, we are firmly in the domain of deep learning.
The big leagues.
Yeah, we are moving totally away from algorithms that need perfectly engineered features, and instead we're using multi-layered neural networks that handle the feature extraction entirely on their own.
And the architecture of the network completely dictates what kind of data it handles best. So for spatial data like images, we use CNNs, convolutional neural networks.
And how do CNNs work? Under the hood.
They essentially slide mathematical filters across the pixels of an image. The first few layers might only detect raw edges or just simple color gradients.
Pretty basic stuff.
Right. But as the data passes deeper and deeper into the network, those edges combine into textures, and those textures combine into recognizable shapes like a wheel or a human face.
But the text notes that CNNs really struggle with time and sequence, right?
Yeah, they don't handle sequential data well at all.
Right. So for temporal data, like a continuous stream of text or stock market ticks, we historically used RNNs, recurrent neural networks, and their advanced variant, LSTMs, which stands for long short-term memory networks.
Yes. LSTMs were a huge breakthrough because they maintain a hidden state. It's basically an internal memory cell that allows them to pass context forward in time.
So it remembers what happened earlier in the sequence.
Exactly. Deciding mathematically what information to retain and what to forget, which solved a major issue called the vanishing gradient problem.
But even LSTMs have been somewhat eclipsed recently. I mean, the true paradigm shift in deep learning, the actual architecture behind the massive large language models we all interact with today, is the transformer.
Oh, absolutely. Transformers just completely discarded the sequential word-by-word processing of RNNs entirely.
Right, because reading sequentially means that by the time the model reaches the end of a really long paragraph, it has mathematically diluted the context of the very first sentence.
It just forgets the beginning.
Yeah. And Transformers solve this with the self-attention mechanism.
Self-attention is genius.
It really is. Attention allows the model to look at every single word in a sequence simultaneously, right? And calculate a weight representing how much each word relates to every other word.
Exactly. It maps the context of the entire sentence in parallel.
Right.
Which not only captures immense nuance in language, but it also allows for massive parallel computing during the training phase.
Which is why we can scale them up so incredibly fast.
Right. The sheer scale of what deep learning can accomplish today is just staggering. But, you know, that brings us to the final and frankly most critical component of the MLOPS framework we're reviewing, evaluation metrics.
Because once an architecture actually makes a prediction, how do we grade it? How do we know it's not just hallucinating or confidently wrong?
Exactly. For regression models, the math is relatively straightforward. We just measure the magnitude of the error. We use things like mean absolute error, which is just the raw average of the mistakes.
But more often, we use mean squared error, or MSE, right?
Yes, MSE is the standard.
And by squaring the error values before averaging them, MSE mathematically punishes the model really heavily for large outliers. Like, it forces the model to care way more about a few massive mistakes than a bunch of tiny acceptable ones.
That's exactly right. But when we grade classification models, the metrics become deeply, deeply nuanced. And honestly, relying on the wrong metric here can be completely disastrous for a business.
The framework breaks down quite a few here: accuracy, precision, recall, the F1 score, and the ROC-AUC. But I want to start by tackling accuracy, because intuitively, accuracy sounds like the only metric you'd ever actually need.
It does sound that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, accuracy is just the total number of correct predictions divided by the total number of guesses. But the framework warns that in real-world scenarios, particularly with imbalanced data sets, accuracy is essentially a dangerous illusion. Why is that?
Well, let me give you the classic example. Imagine a rare disease diagnostic model, okay?
Okay.
Let's say this disease affects exactly 1 in 10,000 people. I can hard code a totally useless algorithm right now that simply predicts healthy for every single person who ever takes the test.
Okay, and because 9,999 of those people are indeed healthy, your useless model is technically going to achieve 99.99% accuracy.
Exactly the problem. The model looks completely flawless on a boardroom slide, but it completely failed its actual real-world objective. It missed the one sick patient.
Wow, yeah. That is terrifying, actually.
It happens more than you'd think. That is exactly why we must decouple our metrics into precision and recall. They allow us to measure the specific types of errors we are making, false positives and false negatives.
Okay, let's define the mechanics of those for everyone. Precision measures the quality of your positive predictions, right? So of everyone the model claimed was sick, how many were actually sick?
Right. And if your precision is low, your model is triggering false alarms everywhere.
Meaning you are sending completely healthy people into expensive, invasive surgeries for no reason.
Exactly. Recall, on the other hand, measures your sensitivity to the ground truth.
Okay.
So of all the people who are actually sick, how many did the model successfully flag? If your recall is low, you're basically sending sick people home and telling them they are perfectly fine.
Which is potentially fatal. And there is always a mathematical tension between the two, isn't there? Like, if you tune the model to just aggressively catch every single potential case so you can achieve 100% recall, you will inevitably flag a bunch of healthy people by mistake, which completely tanks your precision.
And the exact reverse is true as well. So to balance it, we use the F1 score.
Which calculates the harmonic mean between precision and recall.
Yes. It heavily penalizes extreme disparities between the two to give us a single, much more balanced metric.
And to visualize this entire trade-off across every possible probability threshold, we plot what's called the ROC-AUC curve.
Right, which maps the true positive rate against the false positive rate. It allows engineers to decide exactly where they want to set the threshold based on the specific risk tolerance of the business problem they are trying to solve.
So synthesizing everything we've unpacked today on this deep dive, we started by stripping the noise and scaling the data for our algorithms. We explored the rigid boundaries drawn by support vector machines and the ensembled wisdom of random forests in supervised learning.
We watched unsupervised models isolate anomalies in raw data via density clustering.
We discussed the mathematical curiosity of reinforcement learning agents trying to balance exploration and exploitation.
We broke down the parallel context processing of deep learning transformers.
And finally, we examined the rigorous mathematical metrics required to ensure these models are actually solving the problem at hand, rather than just hiding behind high accuracy scores.
The depth of the engineering required to make these systems function is really profound. But, you know, as we step back from the raw mechanics of the MLOPS framework, there is a broader implication embedded in how these systems learn.
Oh, like what?
Well, we spent a lot of time on reinforcement learning today, detailing how agents relentlessly optimize their behavior based entirely on the mathematical rewards and penalties that we define for them.
Right. The agent acts strictly to maximize that cumulative reward function. It has no other goal.
Exactly. And the mathematical reality is that these algorithms have no inherent context. They don't know what they're doing outside of the numbers. As these optimization models are deployed into highly complex, nuanced human systems, whether that's autonomous vehicles navigating city streets or recommendation algorithms curating global news feeds, the challenge shifts from the technical to the conceptual.
Wow. Yeah. How do we mathematically define a reward function for something as abstract as human well-being or ethical behavior or just basic common sense?
Precisely. If a social media model's only directive is to maximize engagement, it will relentlessly optimize for outrage and polarization, completely oblivious to the real-world societal cost.
It optimized the reward perfectly, but it totally ruined the ecosystem.
Right. The algorithms themselves are brilliantly efficient at solving the math problems we give them. But the lingering challenge, as we integrate them further into our infrastructure, is ensuring that the strict mathematical optimization we ask for doesn't violently conflict with human intuition.
So as you encounter these unseen engines in your daily life, the most critical question is no longer just how the machine learns, but who wrote the reward function and what exactly are we asking it to optimize? Definitely something for all of us to mull over today.